everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the production offices.
Post-production.
Post-production offices of Rational Exuberance on the western shores
of Los Feliz Village.
Far away from the downtown core of which I'm used to. I'm Dean Haglund, of course, and with me is my co-host, as always, Mr. Phil Lernes.
Hey, everybody.
Hi. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
It's my Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Well, it's our Chilpack
Hollywood. You know what we mean when we say that it's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
No.
We mean that you listening to this show may at any time write us at chilpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
We insist you do.
chilpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Or you can become a liker of the show on Facebook.
You
at
can.
facebook.com/chilpackhollywood.
So easy.
Or a friend of the show on the abandoned amusement park of the internet that is MySpace,
myspace.com/chillpackhollywood,
where you can always hear the most recent show and read a blog previewing the coming week's show. But in any of those ways, you can write us and interact with us and let us know what you want us to talk about. If you have questions, suggestions, concerns, anything we can help you with.
That's what we're here for.
Dean is happy to give tax advice. And
clearly, I know.
And so that's one of the things that we mean when we say it's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. What we also mean is that if you're a loyal listener of the show, you may end up actually as a guest.
That's
one
right.
day on the show.
That's how it works. Because we have with us a special
and
guest.
We have someone here who is not just the president. He is also a client of Chilpack Hollywood Hour. No, loyal listener, longtime listener, good friend of the show, and first-time guest, storyboard artist extraordinaire, Mr. Rob Consing.
Hi, Rob.
Oh, thanks, everybody.
That's Mr. Microphone.
Though. Oh, how there. Sorry. Yeah, you know, by the way, as a fan of the show, it's really exciting to see the two of you live doing this.
Really?
It's like Hepburn and Tracy. That's wonderful.
That's how we often refer to ourselves.
Which one would be Tracy?
No, I'm Hepburn. No, Tracy.
Both of you turn around and walk in the other room and do it again. No, this is fantastic.
But I'm more Audrey Hepburn is the interesting thing.
Yeah, that's thing.
Oh,
right.
God.
And I'm more Dick Tracy.
Oh, my. That was my nickname in high school. That's awesome.
So does he need to speak a little more closer to the
perfect.
Microphone?
No, it's coming in great.
You keep an eye on it.
We're awesome.
Okay. I'll quit rearing back.
If I wanted you to, Rob, on the spur of the moment, to do a one-word impersonation of Dean Haglund.
What?
When do I ever do that?
You bastard. Oh, those are the only two things I can do, by the way.
Oh, my God.
It's usually funnier when I'm drunk at the Dresden doing it, though.
I must.
Like I said,
I'll
I'm
second
fan,
that.
You know?
That's
I'll
second,
hilarious.
Yeah, when I run into... When I run into...
I never talk like that.
See, that was me right now. You can't even tell.
Wow.
Not used to doing
I
it with pants
so predictable.
Now, Dean Haglund, have been Dean Haglund's been very excited about
very
having you
excited.
As a guest.
Really?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, why?
Because I actually once had dreams of being a storyboard artist myself.
You chose the right path.
What?
You did. No, I'm kidding. No,
what?
What? See, I did it again.
Predictable, Mr. Bond. No, it's fantastic. It's a great job. I love it. But it, as far as the glamour of being an actor goes or being a...
There's glamour?
Yes, or being a stand-up comedian.
With a U. There's glamour with a U.
Have you seen our podcast studio here at the production offices?
I think I've been here.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still in here. This is awesome. Exactly. Are you kidding?
This is what we mean when we say through the magic of podcasting.
No, but I'm excited in terms of the filmmaking process.
Can somebody just answer a question for me? What the hell is a storyboard artist?
Yeah,
that's right there. What the hell is a storyboard artist? Well, a storyboard artist is basically... somebody who illustrates what the director and all the different departments who are collaborating, what we'll do is we'll create a what looks like a comic book, but it's actually a very thought through illustration of what the film will eventually look like. Am I speaking close enough to the microphone?
Yeah, you can see.
There we go. Of what the film will eventually look like.
Right.
And then that gets passed around to the different departments. It's the larger term for it is pre-visualization or pre-vis, but nowadays pre-vis applies more to the computer animatics part of it.
Right.
But storyboards are, you know, since Hitchcock's or even earlier days.
That was the thing. Hitchcock drew his own storyboards.
Well, he did, but he also had some really talented and now legendary storyboard artists doing his stuff. In fact, when I learned how to draw storyboards, I used to go to the academy in Wilshire, and kind of see the exhibits that they had there. I remember the storyboards for Lifeboat and Topaz being particularly influential. And of course, to every storyboard guy, the Art of Star Wars, the Art of the Empire Strikes Back, yeah. Those books, they're just amazing.
So wait, okay, where'd you go to school then to learn storyboard artists? Is there an actual storyboard artist school?
There actually is now, but I went to high school, and I was so horrible at high school. I went to Loyola Catholic Boys School in downtown L.A.
Uh-huh.
And I had to
You were released, though, on good behavior.
No, exactly. No, the sad thing about it is they had to give me all my free periods stacked together because I never got above a 2.6.
Ouch.
Yeah, and so basically I stacked up my free periods, asked my art teacher if I could draw for these films that I was being offered, and the first film I did was a movie that George Clooney was in called Red Surf.
Wow.
In 1989, and I was paid like...
So wait a second, what do you mean? They go around trolling high schools offering kids to do storyboards? How'd this work?
My mentor was an art director named David Brisbane, who's a production designer who did some of the seminal movies of the 80s, including After
Red
Dark.
Red Surf.
Well, no, he didn't do that, but he did After Dark, My Sweet. He did Drugstore Cowboy.
Oh, cool.
You know, he did, God, was it James Foley? Oh, After Dark, My Sweet. He just did The Day the Earth Stood Still and Twilight, one of the Twilight films.
Okay, so we need to back up then, though. So clearly you were already, when did you start drawing?
Oh, I've been drawing since I was a kid. My father was a great illustrator. My brother is as well. My sister is as well.
Who's your brother?
I'm sorry?
Who's your brother? Do I know his illustrations?
Oh, no. He's a good storyboard artist.
Oh,
Raymond Consing.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
So it's a family of storyboard artists.
Family of illustrators and artists. And my sister has her own website. She's a great painter. And she lives in Arizona doing portraits and things like that. And my dad was a primary sort of catalyst for all that. And my whole family. My cousin's a great art director, Paolo. And but my aunt actually was Coppola's assistant on Apocalypse Now. And I used to visit the set when I was a kid.
You flew to the Philippines?
In the Philippines?
Living in the Philippines.
No,
I grew up there. I visited the temple set where all the bodies were hung at the Kurtz's compound.
Yeah,
I visited
right?
when I was a little boy. Yeah, we used to take a river boat up there. It was really crazy.
How traumatizing is that?
Oh, yeah, no, there are real dead bodies there and all that stuff.
Do you remember the Saturday Night Live sketch where when Martin Sheen hosted Saturday Night Live to promote Apocalypse Now?
No.
And Bill Murray played Coppola?
No.
And in the sketch, Martin Sheen played an emissary sent by United Artists to find Coppola and stop him by any means necessary.
I've never heard
the sketch.
Of this.
It's so brilliant because, of course, it more or less, the story, you know, so many of the stories of making it mirror the story in the film itself. But it's true, and you read Richard Bach's final cut, United Artists would send people to try to find out what was going on because they had no contact. There was no internet. There was nothing. They had no contact with the production that was spinning out and out of control, going beyond schedule. So they would send people there to basically say, shut it down.
Yeah.
And these people would come back, you know, raving, going, the man's a genius. Yeah. The man sees things. So anyway, so in this sketch on Saturday Night Live, Martin Sheen plays a character mirroring his character in the movie who's sent basically to hit
Coppola
to take him out. And so when he finally in this sketch meets Coppola played by Bill Murray, you know, he says to him, you know, you've got to shut it down. Well, I'm not going to shut it. Well, look, either you're shutting it down, or in 5 minutes, the helicopters that I've ordered are coming in to blow up your set. And Bill Murray, you know, stops and he goes, blow up my set? You can't. Oh, wait a second. Wait a second. Vittorio, roll cameras. I've got my ending. I've got one of my endings.
I can't believe this exists. I've never. I mean, I know every millimeter of that film.
But it's just so funny. But it's just so funny because, again, so this is why, though, you know, long, funny story aside, maybe you know, this whole thing about the film having two different endings, depending on whether you're seeing the 35mm or the 70mm version, and Coppola only adding fuel to the fire by releasing both. Like, I can't decide what's better.
Yeah, right.
On something like that, what was pre-visualized? What was storyboarded in advance?
Well,
Do you know? That's a good question.
Well, it was storyboarded by the legendary, I believe, Alex Tavolaris, unless he was art director or something like that.
Right.
You mean Dean Tavolaris?
There's both, Alex and Dean. I'm not sure if they're both alive yet. I think I met Alex actually doing a Spike Lee commercial a few years ago, and my aunt passed away quite a few years back. She was very dear to all of us, and actually when I spoke to Alex about it, he kind of teared up. He goes, because to remind him, and Coppola was actually did the eulogy at her funeral, which was beautiful. Yeah, it was really, really touching.
But did the aunt just do Apocalypse Now, or did she
She was with Zoetrope for years. She did The Cotton Club. I believe The Godfather Part 3 was her last film.
Wow.
And she worked on all of the great Coppola sort of artistic things like The Outsiders. I remember seeing photos of this everywhere at my cousin's house. But, you know, seeing Diane Lane and all this other stuff. It was really quite something. But, yeah, Luli was a very, very dear...
So as far as you know, then, what was pre-visualized as the ending?
Well, no, you saw Hearts of Darkness, correct?
Yeah.
There's that one production painting, which is really quite ironic and funny now when you think about it, of Kurtz buffed out, bald, and looking like Mr. Clean with a torn shirt, looking like he just transformed from the Hulk.
Yeah.
Standing over the...
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah, exactly, pretty much. Standing over this gigantic... horizon to horizon set of that temple and hundreds of helicopters and phantom jets coming in and streaking and destroying it. That's what was pre-visualized.
Oh,
now, at least as far as production art goes, I don't know if it was storyboard necessarily, but it was definitely conceptualized. Now, when Brando showed up looking the way he did, that's legendary now, of just him walking in 300 pounds, et cetera. It was, the mortified Coppola. Now, did that change the ending necessarily? No, but they shot it. But what's interesting, though, is the concept had it taking place in the day. And from what I've read about it, the initial helicopter raid, which I consider by far to be the greatest action sequence ever filmed, there's nothing that comes close, except maybe in like Lawrence of Arabia or something like that. But there's nothing that comes close to that in terms of the complexity and scale. Supposedly, the ending was going to top that by a mile.
Wow!
And it was supposed to be set in the day, but interestingly enough, when they firebomb the compound, they show clips of it in I believe the 70mm print, which I saw at the Cinerama Dome so many years ago. That was at night. So, what was the difference? I don't know. All I know is one thing: they weren't fighting back when they bombed in the sequences you see in the 70mm print. No one's fighting back. It's just a flat-out air raid. Whereas in the grand
battle. The grand battle.
Yeah, it's a gigantic, it's spectacular.
But by that time, everybody's so worn down. You blow the shit up. I can't
And Coppola, we were just talking about this the other day, Brando was such a basket case that if the 8 days he was getting, $2 million for?
Right.
He was trashed 4 of those days or didn't want to do anything for 4 of those days. So he was reduced to 4 days of Brando. So that could definitely have affected what he had time to do.
Well, and again, the much like Lawrence of Arabia, and I think it's an apt comparison because you're talking about two films that were made on location.
Yes.
In pre-computer, pre-digital technology days.
It's ridiculous.
And in both cases, the amount of inventiveness that went into literally creating new technology to solve problems on both those films. Some of the earliest computer editing programs were created specifically for Apocalypse Now.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Both Richard and Barbara Marx were who were two of the editors on the film.
The singer Richard Marx.
I believe he started there.
Were two of my advisors on my thesis film, and they would tell me, stories all the time. And every editor was given a section of the film to do. A quarter of the film. There were 4 editors credited.
Yeah.
They all were given a quarter of the film. And they all had to take a pass at the helicopter sequence.
Flawless.
But the two sequences, two really amazing stories, the helicopter sequence, of course, they're up in helicopters shooting stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And not scripted. None of that stuff was scripted. And
really?
The script supervisor could not hear anything.
That makes total sense.
They edited the film together, edited the sequence around the visuals, and then pretty much 2 years after shooting it, had the actors come in to loop it. There's no script. And there's no usable audio that you can hear. So match your mouth to what you think you were saying.
Mm.
And Barbara Marx, talked about, this is understandably a really difficult, a real big challenge for the actors. Robert Duvall came in, watched the scene once, did one pass at it, nailed it.
Really?
He remembered, he just put himself back into the mindset, back into the character, and knew exactly what he had done. The story that they tell about the And I love that, you know, we're doing a show about storyboards and storyboard art, and we're talking about
editing.
No, but we're talking about these sequences that then completely, even in a film that is pre-visualized, these scenes that stand out that are entirely other than what was planned because of, quote unquote, things that went wrong. And yet they come out so memorable because of the talent of the people who are trying to solve the problems.
I would love to know, you know, the scene in Apocalypse Now when the flare enters the helicopter and everyone freaks out and the camera goes wild.
You okay, Lance?
Yeah, you okay, Lance? You're right. It's like, I always wondered, it's just a flare, if that was planned or not, because I swear everyone is horrified when that happens.
Yeah. It's one of those moments where you go, wait a minute, that's not acting.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Sam Bottoms, he played Lance, right? His reaction was not acting. He was just like, God damn it. You
know, but it's entirely possible that maybe a couple of the people knew, but a couple of the performers don't.
But it's a helicopter. You triggered a flare in a moving helicopter with a locked camera. That's just insane. Anyway.
But I feel like the pilot probably knew, but it's not. Maybe no one else
knew. Yeah, he was shielded.
In those scenes with Brando at the end where, like you said, they only had him for a few days now. And so they just had to pretty much lock down camera and roll because, again, he's making all this up.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's improvising all this. So they're in the editing room and they figure out, well, how are we going to cut this? Never mind how do we cut this so that it makes quote unquote sense and is interesting, but literally how do we cut this?
Yeah.
We've got three shots. We've got close up on Brando.
Right.
We have a profile two shot and we've got a close up on Martin Sheen. Yeah. How many times can you cut away to Martin Sheen who doesn't say a word?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just sitting there listening. And keep it going for what you need.
Yes.
And what they said was, who was the DP?
Vittorio Storaro.
Mm-hmm. That he was so bored because the camera was locked down. And he was so bored. So by the end of the first day, he's starting to play around with things. So he's just going to lights. Literally, Storaro himself is going to lights. And he's just been cutting out different, like, shapes and things to move in front of the lights to create shadows that would occasionally pass across him or whatever.
Oh boy.
And they've been cutting this scene together, what are we going to do? And then someone noticed, you know, these strange shadows that Storaro was creating with this. And they go, oh, wait a minute. He may have given us a possibility. If we could recreate these shadows, we could do dissolves without people seeing them. So it required them to really design technically the first linear editing system.
Holy crap, really?
So that they could recreate the without having to do all the expensive opticals because they had to keep testing them. Like we would do on Final Cut today.
Yeah,
they couldn't go through all the time of doing all the opticals and all the different layers when they didn't know because, it's not scripted. So they invented this, and it's just like with, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, inventing the technology you need on the spot.
Oh, no, absolutely. It was the first bleach bypass was Deakin's on. Was it 1984? Same thing. It was like they didn't know what to do, and there's some story about the whole bleach bypass thing was a necessity because something to do
What's a bleach bypass?
Bleach bypass is when you... God, I'm going to screw this
up.
It's
also called skip bleach.
Yeah, when you
skip bleach.
It's when you basically you bleach the print and take out the silver retention. There are people who know this tech stuff better than I am. They're probably puking right now.
What does it look like?
Did you see Jarhead or no? Actually, the best example is
Black Hawk Down, right?
Black Hawk Down, but that's or No Country, not No Country. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Okay,
it's probably one of the most. That was a computerized version of the bleach bypass, which Deakins also shot.
Right,
and it kind of creates a sort of bleached out, kind of washed out look.
Desaturated colors.
But back
for
then...
For the whole movie.
But it's a risk back then. Seven, actually, I remember was being the one film that really jumped out at me as doing the beach bypass. It's a much more powerful contrast. Black becomes more black because of the silver retention in the print. But now you can really do it through DI. But of course, everyone overuses it now.
Yeah, exactly. That's all you see in all the horror movies.
And this is, always what's interesting about it to me is that, when the technology is developed, it's so often developed really to solve a problem a lot of times.
And look what linear editing has come to now. Yeah.
And now, you know, when you have all this at your disposal. So often using it isn't motivated by how do we creatively get our, this conversation of artists needing something to push against.
Yeah.
It's not a problem. It's an opportunity because you get to use your creative imagination to solve it.
Right. But speaking of that, then, that's what storyboards are supposed to
do. Well, storyboarding took a... Funny, we were talking about war films and, you know, storyboarding and pre-visualization. Storyboarding took a kind of a hit creatively when Saving Private Ryan was done, because no one would ever argue that Private Ryan is not probably the pinnacle of action filmmaking as well. I mean, it's the same with even Schindler's List. They're two films that are so kinetic and so spectacularly done, but there's an element of spontaneity in the filmmaking that you kind of think, well, maybe this wasn't pre-planned. But of course, Spielberg, who was one of the biggest proponents of storyboarding, turned around and said, well, you know what, storyboarding is something I didn't do on this. I just made it up as I went along. And some directors kind of went along with that. They're like, no, we're going to try and do this without boards. But there is boards. There were boards that were drawn.
For Saving Private Ryan, there was boards.
Yes, there were. And there were really great conceptual illustrations.
And even if there weren't, he had so completely storyboarded so many of his films throughout his career that even if it wasn't storyboarded,
he knew it in his head.
And I think this is like with Hitchcock.
Yes.
You know, what people always say about Hitchcock, he edited the films in advance in his head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so to a certain degree,
he had that down.
He has it already
down.
Even if
he was just improvising the whole.
Well, he's also embraced a computer pre-visualization of films. The animatics that you see, or 3D previs animatics that you see in most making of documentaries and things like that. But there's still storyboards are definitely the foundation for any sort of first pass at a film. And you know, before the storyboards would just go to a visual effects company and they would do the previs themselves and then bounce it off, and that process could take months. I remember on Armageddon, that was the thing, where I would storyboard the film as detailed as I could. It would go off. They'd send back previs that took months. Now previs is done by really talented and really amazing teams on the film itself. You know, with teams, when I was on, I just finished Transformers 3 a few months ago. There's 29 guys, 15 at ILM, 7... Did I just my math correct?
Yeah.
A bunch of guys at ILM, a bunch of guys in Los Angeles working directly with Bay. And it was fantastic. I mean, you could see the whole film coming to life. I was the only guy there storyboarding, and it was a lot of fun because you get to walk back and forth, and you see these guys just creating this, you know, this, in my opinion,
but part. Who is doing the actual visualization, though? Is it the...
Well, let's make this a little bit... Okay. At what point does the storyboard artist come on to the film?
Storyboard, well... In some cases, when I started Bad Boys 2 in Pearl Harbor, there was nothing. There's absolutely nothing.
Not even a script?
No. Michael would come in and say, in Pearl Harbor's case, we brought in Randall Wallace, and this is how we want it to go. Better still, Bad Boys 2. Michael brings me in. I think we had Jerry Stahl, who's one of my heroes. He wrote Permanent Midnight, one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
And he basically said, okay, they're going to take down a big drug dealer, and the ending... We have to come up with the best car chase ever, and the ending is going to be in Guantanamo Bay. And that's all we had. And,
wow.
And Michael, Jerry, and I flew down to, with Barry Waldman, flew down to Miami and literally started walking around thinking of ways to kill people for weeks.
And you bring a sketchbook with you at that point?
No, at that point, not even. You know. Well, I had one at my hotel, and you know, the second the scout was over, I'd run back. And like I remember Michael saying on the way back, and we were flying back in this jet, and I was on my word processor just tapping away what I thought the beats should be in the action scene. And by the way, Michael visually is so on top of things, and thematically as well, that he was writing the sequences with me, but it was so nice to be there at that genesis point. And basically then he would hand the action scenes over to the writer, and that's what we had.
Right. So you would draw it, physically, or are you writing the beats?
I'm writing the beats first, because, you know...
So you do a word pass first on storyboards before you draw it out?
Depending. I mean, if there's, like, I'm on Spider-Man now, and we have a fantastic writer, Jamie Vanderbilt, who wrote Zodiac, and Mark Webb is a fantastic writer himself, too, and he invents the sequence with you. Sometimes you can come up with, like, the germ of an idea that'll trigger an inspiration and so on and so forth. But for the most part, you know, it just depends on the director, the writers, and how far along it's gone. There are times when you come on board and you're like the fourth guy on, and there's like three other storyboard guys who've been on for 6 months. You weren't available yet, or they decided they needed somebody else. It's so many different... You know,
well, so, and what's the evolution then of the storyboard? So it seems to me then there are many drafts of the story.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could do, right now I'm probably on my fifth pass of one sequence on Spider-Man.
And that's not because of rewriting so much as because different departments and different artists...
Rewriting, you're hewing it to something that's a lot more doable or a consolidation of sequences. In Mark Webb's case, he's really concerned with character and character development and making sure that the plot is really tight. And so, you know, scenes that might have been a lot of fun to do, like we've done earlier passes of things, suddenly become something much sharper and much more efficient. Same with Transformers 3. I mean, we were doing stuff that was probably way too large and way too ridiculously overscaled.
Wait, there was something too large for Transformers 3?
Wait, the teaser's coming out with Harry Potter, I think. It's, yeah. From what I understand, people I know who've seen the stuff they showed at the rap party, because it was in Chicago, is unbelievable.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Trust me, I've seen some stuff of it already.
Well, so how then, though, is your work intertwined with and influenced by, let's say, costume design? Or production design.
Or special effects.
Well, the departments, I'm at the meetings in the departments. We all, as a storyboard artist, you have to make sure that your work is doable, realistic, and completely within the film's, you know, sort of aesthetic.
But,
and,
like, are you getting the costume sketches?
Yeah, there's
and then you're incorporating those into the story.
Probably one of the most protected things in a film is the server. And basically you tap in and every single visual element, from the costume design to the sketches done by the conceptual people, and even the location photos. And you go on the scouts as well. I mean, not in this case, because everything's going to be created for us in this case.
Right.
Spider-Man's a very heavily art-directed film. And that's going to be all of us sort of checking in and making sure that our work is accurate. And there are times, you know, it doesn't really matter if, let's say, Peter Parker's watch doesn't look like Peter Parker's watch, but it does matter that, you know, if such and such is... if the villain can't fly, or if he jumps, he's going to slam into the top of the set, kind of a thing.
Right, right.
You have to create a realistic environment for the stunt people to not look at the work and go, what is he talking about? This is stupid. This isn't going to work. This is technically amateurish. You know,
because,
that kind of thing.
Again, the watch will be decided by whichever company
exactly.
ponies up enough money for the product placement.
Oh, that's happened.
So,
I've been corrected on that level.
Are you drawing it physically on paper, or what are you working on?
I'm one of the last paper holdouts.
Are you?
Yeah, well, I'm one of the last few, actually. A few good friends of mine are really great storyboard guys, and they still draw on paper, but the majority of them draw on either Wacom tablets, which are these amazing graphic tablets that look like monitors and you can draw directly on it.
Oh.
Or simpler pads, which you look at the monitor but you draw on the pad.
Right, right.
Because I see that on, you know, my beloved Project Runway, all the...
They're
all sketching on their HP pads.
Oh, no, Cintiq is the cool thing. It's $2,000 or $1,500, and it's the sexiest thing you've ever seen. It's a 21-inch monitor, little few buttons on the side, and you draw directly on it.
Ooh.
It's effing cool.
Wow.
I mean, seriously, it's
now, how come you're still doing pen to paper? Is there something organic to that? Or?
I have a few friends who don't use their Cintiq except as a monitor, because there's a little bit of a lag time when you put the pen to the monitor, and that stuff drives me crazy. And that's why I've never used a pad, because there's that little lag in my... I haven't played video games in a while, so my eye-hand coordination is a little off. I practice it in other ways,
right.
But it's just a little off time, and that's a major thing for me. Kinda
okay,
drives me crazy.
So let's take us through like a scenario. Phil is the director. I'm the producer.
What?
You're the storyboard artist.
Again.
Okay. And we got a big thing. And I'm saying, okay, we got $2 million. Phil, what's our idea for this big action sequence? Phil says, I want... What do you want? A car chase or something?
I'll do the one where the whole movie that I was doing the behind the scenes on got created because of something a buyer had said. They knew they could get a certain amount, like $2 million, from a buyer in Japan.
Right.
And so this man said to the producer and the director, "Here's what I want: spider eat car."
Huh?
He wanted to see a spider eat a car.
Spider eat a car, because we can get $2 million from Japan.
Yeah,
spider eats a car.
So we need an action scene where a spider eats a car.
Then now that's fallen on you. What do you do?
Now, first of all, is this a domestic drama? Sorry,
we don't know yet.
It stars Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek.
Oh, I'm in. Okay.
So what would you do with the meeting at that point?
Well, I mean, I hate to sound crass, but the first thing I would do is ask, what movies influence you? What are the? Of course, if you want to reinvent the wheel, that's wonderful. But I would really like to know, is it Bullet? Is it, God, The Rock? Is it, you know, whatever? What?
Okay, well, when I have a conversation with the director of photography, for example, you know, usually I'm referencing paintings.
Mm-hmm.
When someone is working with references to you, are you thinking it terms more of it would seem to me not the static, but referencing sequences.
Sequences, absolutely sequences. I mean, when you're talking about something as kinetic as a car chase, and also that's been done as often as a car chase, you want to have at least an inspiration or basis to go from, to
right.
start from. Because what tends to happen if you do something that's, if you show someone a static representation, like a photograph, it's really not enough. Because what you need to know is the tone of it. For example, the Bourne Supremacy car chase was like the giant paradigm shift in car chases, the way The Rock was in its day and right. Bullet was in its day. And personally, my favorite is always going to be To Live and Die in L.A.'s car chase, more than the French,
or the French Connection too, but Live and Die in L.A.
Because it's that perfect combination of really spectacular editing and directing combined with the fact that you really don't know how the hell they just did that. Why didn't these people just get killed? Bourne Ultimatum films, even though they're chopped up by Cuisinart, you still get that sense that they just performed a really dangerous stunt in multiple camera placements as opposed to cutting in and around it to create that illusion.
This is a really interesting comment that the Dean was made. You know, we're both huge fans of the Casino Royale.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Craig,
fantastic.
First film is Bond. I am not a fan of
Quantum of Solace.
Quantum of Solace. Ooh. Dean liked it much more.
Yeah,
I love Quantum of Solace.
I disliked it both in terms of the fact that it, you know, it just wasn't. They took a really interesting James Bond character and now put him in kind of a boring, uninteresting world. But also you went from a film where the action is so incredible in the first one to a film where the action is completely uninvolving in the second one. And Dean's comment was that he could tell in watching the action in the second one that they got all the shots that they need, that they clearly shot incredible action sequences, but in terms of how it was put together, it prevented involvement, and that kind of opened my eyes to a couple things. One was I began to, as I would watch films with action sequences, start to really pay attention to ones that were very well done and started to realize that I was recognizing certain editors' work. That now I could see editors' hands in this specifically.
Well, the legendary Stuart Baer did Casino Royale, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm seeing this and I go, you know, oh my God, this had to be the same guy. And sure enough, it is the same guy.
Uh-huh. And that's my belief of Martin Scorsese. Thelma Schumacher. Yeah.
But we'll find out about Sally Menke soon enough, right?
But
right?
So this then would be, you know, how much of what, let's say Dean's right, that they shot everything that they needed to make a fantastic action sequence. Mm-hmm. How much of the sequence falling flat through being uninvolving compared to, let's say, the first film might be a result of the initial storyboards,
right,
might be a result of choices then that are made simply in the editing room.
Well, hold on, let me jump in on one thing. First of all, I think Quantum of Solace is fantastic, and I think it's
no Casino Royale.
No, absolutely not. But being said, the opening of Casino Royale has to be one of the greatest bits of action filmmaking ever seen. The whole Parker thing,
totally.
However, that being said, by the way, having worked on dozens of PG-13 films that are trying to get out of that R rating and having scenes handed back to you saying, oh, that's not going to get us a PG-13. The fact that Casino Royale is PG-13, it's probably one of the most violent things I've ever seen. That opening sequence when he kills, not shoots the guy, but when he beats the crap out of that guy in the bathroom.
Well, how about needing to be brought back to life also with the paddles?
Spoiler alert, shooting Chiffre in the head.
Yeah.
No, it's terrible. I
do it worse.
Unconsciously. Anyway, that kind of stuff.
But he said the spoiler alert before saying the spoiler.
Oh, yeah, I always say it after.
Yeah. Well, by the way, that was just a spoiler.
Well, no, but do I think that, first of all, a lot of these things do have, a lot of surprises hit you as a storyboard artist when you see the film in the final product. So it just depends on how troubled the sequence was or how hard it was to finish or how great it was in the beginning before you even, it depends on the director. Martin Campbell is a master. Mm-hmm. Mark Forster turned it all over to one of the best second unit directors on the planet, Dan Bradley. Dan Bradley and also Simon Crane. Simon Crane did all of Doug Liman's films like Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Who we were talking about on last week's show.
Simon Crane, right. And he writes and invents a lot of the action. And he sort of hired, he did Salt as well. Dan Bradley did the Bourne films. And maybe that's why you're having a bit of a negative reaction, because they wanted that Bourne feeling, kid. Well, that Greengrass feeling.
Did he do the Doug Liman Bourne film?
No, he did not.
And right. Which is why I still, again, I think that's the really good one. That's the pinnickle of them.
Oh, no, I disagree. Nah. I'm loving the Greengrass ones.
I thought they got less and less interesting as
really?
They went along.
Yeah. Whereas, I have a hard time watching The Bourne Identity. To me, it's sort of like watching sort of like the first shot at these films, and I think I'm alone in that, frankly.
No, certainly not
in this room.
I'm not a big Bourne fan across the board.
No, across the board. But Bourne Ultimatum is actually, and Bourne Supremacy, I think, is probably a superior film to Bourne Ultimatum. But Bourne Ultimatum has two of the best things ever: that the great fight between the great fight in, was it Spain, I think,
Morocco. The first one has Morocco. The best. The two
car
best
chase.
Things has the two best things in any of the
it
movies.
Has, it
Clive
has
and Owen.
Hey now,
Man crush.
But that's very interesting. You know, you talked about the handing off then
back to Martin Campbell. My friend Eric Ramsey just finished The Green Lantern, and he said that he storyboarded that for a long time, and Martin knew every frame of what he wanted to do. So when you pass that level of commitment and vision to a second unit director, as great as they are, it's still going to be Martin's vision. Whereas from what I understand, Mark Forster relied heavily on both Dan Bradley and Simon Crane to execute his vision.
Well,
they're both fantastic directors.
You know, the action sequence that stands out for me in Quantum of Solace as being having actual life to it is the big opera sequence.
That was the most clever thing in the film.
It was the most clever thing. And you know what? What was the opera? What was it again? Do we remember what the opera
giant
was?
Eye, and yes. They were doing. It wasn't Aida. It was Tosca, wasn't it?
Yes. I wish I could remember which.
It was Tosca. Well, God, I don't remember.
Well, but this is what's interesting about it, because I was at a dinner party with a close friend of Mark Forster's after that film came out, and I said, you know, that's the only sequence with any kind of action or whatever that really came to life, and this friend of Mark Forster said, well, that's the only action sequence that he had any interest in. Mm. And in fact, that's the movie that he wanted to make. He always wanted to make that opera into a film.
Wow, he's a Joel Schumacher.
And so he, worked it into the film. Wouldn't it be great to do this as a set piece to use all these ideas that I had always about bringing that to life? But sometimes that's important.
It's a fantastic scene.
It roots it in some kind of human thing.
So let's take it back then. Okay, we want a spider eating a car, and I'm the producer.
Oh, sorry.
And I want Children of Men, final battle sequence. That's the
thing.
Oh,
my God.
A single camera shot.
Another pinnacle.
Yeah,
another pinnacle.
Right? That's fantastic. How would you even storyboard
that?
Well,
okay, now, first of all, the storyboard guy is the Santa Claus of the film. He's going to give you everything you want at first, because the first pass is always the best. You know, it could be a $1 million film, and I'll give you a 20-minute tracking shot taking place in a destruction of Mars. You know, it's...
Right.
That's
what I want.
And I can ground it in as much... at that point, the best thing you can do is make your drawings as representational of the correct camera work, as kinetic as possible.
And I see those things where there's like big arrows in the middle of it, and you do all that sort of thing? Like
absolutely, as close as you can get. I mean, you want to create that sort of excitement, especially that early, where you're allowed to draw a little heavier and kind of nail the sketching of it right. After a while, it just becomes, you know, feeding the machine and getting them out for information's sake.
Right.
But in the beginning, it's all
yourself, the sizzle.
Yeah, all sizzle. As I'd say, all flash. You know, you're doing what you can to make the movie this sort of like this golden child of perfection.
Right.
Then after that, that's when they start tweaking stuff.
Right. Okay. Then I say,
that's
I only have a million. I got 50 cents for the scene.
Yeah, yeah. That's screw that. That's when the 40-foot spider can eat the Ferrari.
Right.
Then after that, it's paper mache and Yugos. You know,
right.
It's
going to be an optical real spider on a I see. So then at that point, you then have to redraw it to match that kinetic energy off the first one? Or what happens?
Well, sometimes you move on to other stuff. There's going to be other spider-eating car moments in the movie, unless it's the one thing you were hired to do.
Right.
But what you try to do is really sort of, even in the most realistic of possible things, if the director allows you to conceptualize an action sequence or even a dramatic sequence, you give him the best you can do under the circumstances. Even you can figure out that it shouldn't cost $500 million, and you give them that. You make it work.
And then those storyboards, do they go to the special effects, like the digital guys, and then they draw from that?
Yeah, after everyone has a hack at it. You know, usually, sometimes the production designer will weigh in and say, you know, does it have to be a metal spider? You know, why not a glass spider? And then the visual effects people will say, well, it's very hard to do a CGI version of a smooth surface. Can we have a hard impacted surface with, like, these little pockmarks that they'll translate to light bending on them better in our software?
And that's what happened with District 9. To draw, you have to draw that in your storyboard then?
Yes,
you
absolutely. Back, you yeah, yeah.
Oh,
well,
okay.
Maybe not in if the spider still has the same shape and scale, but if it changes the scene, if suddenly I can't do a low angle because the low angle has moving parts which are going to cost a lot more to animate,
right,
then a high angle would work best, and suddenly it's the master shot is going to be the big sell.
Is there
more important?
Do you have your sample of your work on your website?
Yeah, if you look up my name on IMDb, it'll show you the
spell
boards.
Your name for the listeners.
R O B B I E.
Yeah.
C O N. S-I-N-G.
It'll actually be on the description of the show. Oh, right. I will oh, yeah. actually mention
will
Robbie
you link it to
in the description of the
yeah.
show.
Okay,
totally,
good.
Yeah. And also there's an interview with me on FilmNut, which is a great little sort of website that sort of I do a similar interview where I talk and I take questions from the listeners, which is hilarious because it's all these Terminator freaks that are jumping on board. And when I was doing the interview, I could see the rude comments that were appearing. It's like, this guy looks like a jerk. I'm like, thanks.
That's why we don't go live. That's all we get to. Hey, what a bunch of jerks.
I'd have to wear pants too. Which,
yeah. Oh, we forgot to mention it's pantsless day.
Pants are always optional.
That's right.
Bring your daughter
in the
to
offices
work.
Of no rational exuberance.
Right. This looks awesome. Rational to me.
It's the exuberant part.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the furniture in these, or as I like to call them, actors.
Yes. Hey now.
Alfred Hitchcock, right, once said that he does not move the camera. The director doesn't move the camera. The actor moves the camera. This is what Hitchcock said, which seemed so kind of not honest because he was storyboarding everything and expected actors to hit their marks.
He might have meant that in an entirely different way now that I think about it.
Right.
But
how did he mean it?
But he did mean it, I think, in this sense that this idea of, you know, directors love moving the cameras. You know, it's like, oh, he's really good at moving the camera or whatever, as opposed to this sense that, no, the camera is moving because the character is moving it.
Right. Well, your personality, your vision, and I'm sorry, can we continue with the
question? Well, so there's this kind of distinction between, you know, having kind of this really clearly subjective camera work.
Yeah.
As opposed to what you can say that Hitchcock did, that the circumstances in which the character found his or herself, their action, their movements is what motivated the camera moves.
Right.
What was motivating those actors and characters' movements to begin with was what he had already designed and storyboarded.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess my question is, and, you know, we've talked about why there aren't any good action actors anymore, why they're really, it's so hard to find anything that are believed.
Daniel Craig is fantastic.
But you know, the reason that we do go back to Bruce Willis in Die Hard 5 and Die Hard 6, the reason we're all okay with a 60-something-year-old Indiana Jones, the reason we're okay with Stallone who can't walk anymore, but then we'll take a whole bunch of human growth hormone to be able to do a Rambo or a Rocky and we're okay with it, is that we don't have a generation of performers, nearly as many, that are as believable in those kind of films.
Name one.
Well, here's...
Well, Daniel Craig.
One of the best physical performances I've seen in years, and I got my little man crush going, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt in Inception.
Okay.
That's
I would have said Brick. How about his action performance
or Brick,
in Brick?
Yeah, absolutely. Brick, yeah. And maybe he wasn't dancing or doing anything remotely too actiony, but I thought Tom Hardy in that film was fantastic. Their physical presences in that film. And DiCaprio is a great actor. I remember watching The Beach, which is not a great film, but his physicality in that film really, really blew me away.
Clive Owen
in Children of Men. Absolutely.
We've talked about this. The performance, you know, you're never going to get an Oscar for that kind of work, but when you think what he went through as an actor in that last sequence, as great as everything else is, there is so much riding on him as a performer that you would never be aware of unless it didn't work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so... So that's, you know, when you see him really stepping on glass and you're going, he's clearly stepping on glass because he's barefoot the whole time, you know, and all this stuff. But this is what I wanted to kind of get at, is that I could see the problem that a lot of films can get in as, you know, with greater and greater expense and, you know, greater and greater time restrictions, the more important all this pre-visualization is. And at the same time, though, when you're locking, trying to lock as much as you can in visually, there's less and less room for an actor to show up in a set, in a location, whatever, and really figure out the way that they would do it, that the character would really move through it. There's less time for that. There's less of this, which it seems to me makes it all the more important you have an actor that can
carry that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What makes what made Sean Connery so great as Bond, among, you know, all the obvious attributes aside?
He moved like a panther.
Yes, he moved like a panther. And it's not just in the action scenes. It's that you believe his movement in all the non-action scenes. Like, he really knows where he's going and he knows why he's going there. And there isn't... It's almost like a Meisner masterclass that you're watching, like with Mad Men, the pouring of the cocktails. Yeah. I mean, you really feel like it's a real... This set is a real world. And
that's Ken
and
Adams
that's
too.
Why I feel in some respects we don't have the action stars that we have because we used to have because actors like Harrison Ford, he is a really good actor in that you believe that the world that he's in is real.
Yeah. If you provide the actor with the world, I think, I mean, I even Keanu Reeves was great in The Matrix because they gave him the stage that he needed to work with. And also, and back to Connery and some of the old school sort of, you know, great guys like Bogart, who, now Bogart never had to do an extreme action sequence. Well, you know, people will probably be arguing with that one, but but I'm just thinking of like something like a Bourne Supremacy or where the action is as fast as the editing is. They never had to test the idea of having to hit motion capture level X's that they had to stand at, or, you know, Humphrey Bogart didn't have to react to a robot,
right.
kind of a thing. And, you know, a lot of people crap on Shia LaBeouf, but I actually have a tremendous amount of respect for what he does, because when you imagine having that sort of like Bob Hoskins experience in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and when Bob Hoskins did it, we were all like stunned by that. Shia's done two movies worth of that while having crap exploding around him under shots that are under no circumstances easy to do, much less follow as an actor. I mean, as an actor, I can't even imagine hitting those kinds of marks. I acted for one day in one of Michael's movies.
You acted for one day?
Yeah, it was horrible.
And again, not 3 days, actually. Not just hitting the marks, you know, and that, you know, again, getting back to Hitchcock, you know, just learn your lines and hit your marks. Don't bump into the furniture. But that's all well and good. But Cary Grant... not only hit the marks, but he made you believe that it was authentic and it was organic and that there was a real reason that he was hitting that mark. And that's the challenge. But it's not like Jason, you know, I like Jason Statham, but it's not like Jason Statham is bad at hitting marks. He's great at hitting the marks. He has almost a dancer's precision to him. I just don't necessarily buy a lot of time that there's a character hitting the mark. Whereas with a lot of these actors, and I would say even with Shia LaBeouf, at least a lot of the time, I do believe that there's a character doing it. Now, can he do anything other than what we've seen? Well, he's yet to prove it.
Shia blows away Cary Grant
Now, that's Robbie. A movie I'd love to see.
I know, exactly.
Just kidding. Just kidding, everyone.
Okay, so then back to storyboards then.
Right.
Your responsibility then to... The actor,
yes,
acted in that,
and to the director, my boss. Sorry,
go ahead. No, finish
but that. I mean, but this is the question. This is the question: is that do you ever feel like, you know, okay, we're locking an actor into something that may not be playable, or that,
and the stuff I'm playing around with, I had to just consider the storytelling primarily, because to even consider whether or not what the actor is going to be able to do, when it's just going to be he's going to be a blip before he crashes through a window, dives into the spaceship. Oh God, it sounds horrible, but you know what I mean. When you're creating these very, and let's face it, an action sequence in modern day filmmaking, sometimes by its nature, is fairly contrived. It has to have a certain set of beats you have to hit. If you want to be crass and cynical about it, it's to sell a toy. If it's not, it's to sell the sequence, to give it the kind of thing, that to give it a trailer moment. But if you really, really can dig deep into, you know, the heart of the scene and the movie, and you're working with fantastic people, which I feel like I am now. You are actually.
You mean in this podcast?
Yeah. This
yes,
podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey now.
Yeah, and that you do get inspired to kind of really ride the, you know, to ride the sequence exactly the way that they want it to be written, and to create exactly the way they want to see it, with keeping the characters in mind. But that being said, no, I don't really think about what they're capable of doing, or even consider what the ideal showcase for an actor would be. But the character is another matter entirely. And, you know, chances are when we start a film, especially if it's a quote-unquote original film.
Right.
I mean, I didn't know Andrew Garfield was going to be Spider-Man. It could have been, you know, Jamie Bell or whoever for all I knew. All I knew is that Tobey Maguire might have been mildly imprinted in my head, but we were trying to go for something different, and we had to throw the whole Sam Raimi playbook out the window. As much as I loved especially the second one, you can't think about stuff like that.
Right. Now, when you're drawing the storyboard, are you actually trying to do a pictorial representation, yeah, like a portrait of those guys?
My friends are way, way, way better at that stuff than I am. Really? I'm horrible. I mean, I've
probably... Your sister's a portrait painter.
Yeah, she is. I'm not. I know. Trust me, I've screwed up a lot of chances with women just because they're like, "Can you draw me?" I'm like, "I can't unless you're in a cyber suit. It's not gonna happen." You know,
so
it's
get
terrible.
Dressed.
Yeah, exactly. Put the amp suit on. We're going to Pandora.
But I would think that there's an advantage to that to a certain degree that
you keep it neutral.
Yeah, you keep it neutral. This is the character.
Well, yeah, especially if it's not cast. I mean, Andrew Garfield has such a specific face.
Yeah.
Shia has such a specific face. But when I started Transformers, it wasn't Shia.
And I know commercials where you go in for an audition, and you see the storyboards, they just cast the guy who looks like the drawing. They don't care anybody's performance. They just go, "Oh yeah, that guy looks."
But
nice.
That's a physical type.
Yeah, because commercials 30 seconds, you got to get that across.
But exactly,
and it fit all the demographic research. They said that we need to have this kind of face for this long to appeal to Kansas City.
The drawings are always god awful. It seems like the one guy does commercials.
Well, also commercials, they're really. I don't enjoy doing commercials, although I've been lucky enough to work with really talented commercial people. For the most part. The problem with doing commercials is it has to be as completely saccharine as possible. You know, it's people drinking soda and enjoying it. I remember, I'm one of those people. Someone once said, all your drawings, and if you look in the IMDb site, this is true, all the people, soldiers, they all look like they're taking a dump while being shot at. And everyone's got these grit, mortal fear, agony faces while running from whatever. And, you know, I've had to reboard entire commercials' faces just because they're like, can you make them look a little less scary? I'm like, sure, I'll do that.
Yeah.
And like, not the women look like men, you know, that kind of thing. It's just not. It's
so what way, I've got some interesting, like, lightning round questions.
Okay, quick
for
lightning
Robbie.
Round for everybody.
What way are storyboards used that you think maybe is problematic?
The use of storyboards being problematic. Well, that would really go back to that question about the actors that you said, where you're straitjacketing what could be actors wanting a more, you know, less constrictive flow. I mean, as an actor, you understand this when they want you to hit these marks and do this and that really quickly. I know this is lightning round, but Alec Baldwin was complaining about a certain director, and I know it happened to be Philip Juano. Did I pronounce
that
right?
Juano, yeah.
Juano on Heaven's Prisoners, where, you know, you're trying to pull back sense memory and pull up some horrible event that happened to you, and you're crying, you're retching, you're having physical reactions to the material, and even in the back of your head, you're going, as miserable as you are at this moment, I nailed it. And then suddenly the guy goes, oh shit, you missed your eye line on that Steadicam shot at the fifth mark. Because it's, you know, you start from the bottom of the thing, and you have a great DP like Harris Savitas who shot Heaven's Prisoners, and everything's perfect, and you blow that eye line, and that's the thing, you know. And now if you're Scorsese, that's fine, because you're like, okay, no, I just blew it for Marty, fuck that, I'm gonna go back and do it again.
Yeah,
but you know, certain other circumstances, especially Alec Baldwin in his heyday of.
But I also feel that one of the reasons that you're that way with Marty is that he understands the actor's process so much and can communicate to the actor on their terms and in their language. So therefore, you're going to automatically want to work harder to make
exactly
what he wants happen.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, take 8, take 9, take 10. Fincher is notorious for erasing takes in front of his actors. And I found out that this... Jake Gyllenhaal on Zodiac, famous story, walked up to Fincher and like on the 80th take of... No, 60th take, sorry, of a very, very, very long day. They're just like, I'm sorry, David, what do you want? And David just turns to him and says, I'll tell you what I don't want. And he erased all the takes up until that point.
Well, you know what's interesting is that I kind of felt, getting back to our social network conversation, I felt like Jesse Eisenberg was intentionally not trying anything.
Really?
Largely because of that. And I said, you know, he came as close in The Social Network to giving a bad performance as anyone who's perfectly cast can, in that we'd seen everything he'd done before. There was no pushing against anything. Mm-hmm. But again, it gets back to the weakness that I've often said about with Fincher's work, is that there is no variation. There is no tonal arc whatsoever in his work.
But for that film,
it's actually appropriate, because nor is there a tonal arc on the internet.
I don't think so. I actually disagree with that. I think that Fincher has probably one of the most, like Ridley Scott, one of the most undervalued use of actors. I remember a lot of people saying that the first Alien film is like just all flash and no substance. But to me, it has the most naturalistic performances of any science fiction film, much less Alien, with the exception of Never Let Me Go. But back to Social Network, Andrew Garfield was fantastic. And so was Justin Timberlake. A lot of people poo-pooed the Timberlake, but I liked the JT. He was great.
Yeah, but you're not talking about an actor, actually. I think Fincher is very good with non-actors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go. But they're great performances.
Right. And I'm just saying that I think that Jesse Eisenberg, for any actor who is perfectly cast, like we were talking about Scott Pilgrim and how I said, you know, it's one of the best performances by anyone who's not well cast in a movie. And here's Jesse Eisenberg, who's perfectly cast, and it's his least interesting performance.
But you've seen what's his name, Mark Zuckerberg, in interviews and like 60 Minutes, especially. Right. And I thought that shifty-eyed stuff was, you know.
So how are storyboards not used, and yet, in your eyes, could be used in a way that they're not being used?
Well, that's funny. It's almost the reverse of what I just said, which is I think they're actually very effective in dramatic sequences, in sort of plotting out the dramatic truth of things, especially when it comes to editing the sequences together, because there are times when visually...
Again, Hitchcock did this.
Yes, absolutely. And there are times when I'm on a film, and I'm able to board the whole thing all the way through for like a year... and whatever. And of course, unfortunately, those aren't movies that are going to be renowned for their dramatic texture or whatever. That's always going to be the bombast films. And you're on a little bit of less prioritized time, so you can kind of tackle the stuff that's a little more sensitive. But, you know, you've bored everything, and it's just there. And it creates a chance for the director to walk the scene before it's ever conceptualized. And as a director as well, you kind of sense, okay, I would do that. You may have a script and start drawing little boxes and putting little faces. You've directed, Phil. You know, you understand. It's like, this is something that you need to do. Now, maybe not on the past two films you've done, but it's something it's very, very important. Now,
yeah, I mean, like on the last two, obviously, or on the last one, you know, it's about, I can't know at all what's going to happen. Because if for a moment, you know, which is because we want you to believe it's a documentary.
But Karl Rove is something that you did kind of have to create a little bit of planning, right? I mean, it can't be that spontaneous.
I had to plan very rigorously the spontaneity.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Exactly.
I had to put real safeguards into place so that you could never, ever think that I was ahead of the audience at any point.
It's strategery.
But I also love this idea that, you know, the dramatic scenes, because oftentimes you will see films that really feel like, I'm not saying that this is where they did this, but I remember, you know, The Matrix, everything was so wonderfully woven together. Mm-hmm. Then you see The Matrix 2, and it's, why does it feel like all the quote-unquote dramatic scenes were directed by somebody and all the action scenes were directed by somebody else?
Because there are two of them.
And there are two of them. But this idea of, so often in action films, it doesn't feel like the same movie. Mm-hmm. You've got one movie when there isn't action and one movie when there is action.
Well, you know who boards every frame of their spectacular stuff is the Coen brothers.
Oh, is that right?
And they love their storyboard guy.
And so it's cohesive.
J.T. Anderson, I believe, is his name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
awesome.
And they gave him a chance to direct already because they love him so much. And he's as much a part of... It's like a three-headed monster on that one.
Hmm.
And the acting, obviously, in the Coen brothers. But there is a... you know, a level of sort of pre-planning that you can see. I mean, you don't sit there and watch Coen Brothers and go, wow, that looks spontaneous. It doesn't.
Right.
But it's perfect.
Right.
So if I want to break into storyboarding, should I answer those Craigslist things that say for $100 to do my independent film?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, no. That's no joke. I mean, look, I used to do AFI short films. I used to do UCLA short films. And it's funny, I lecture.
And you will again.
I know.
Don't sell yourself.
I know, exactly. I strive for the big stage. And you know, you trade favors sometimes. I remember I needed someone to edit my reel, and I did storyboards for somebody. This is like just 5-6 years ago. You know.
Wow.
Then I sold him my couch. That's great.
Well, maybe you could storyboard next week's Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Yeah. I would love to.
That would be good, because right now it's just a two shot of us staring at each other.
No, we need
longingly.
In a Spencer Tracy kind
remember
of.
Remember what I said about the pants? It's all good.
Nay. Oh my gosh.
So what on one an ant's thing? Pay. What one thing do people before. Maybe not know about storyboard artists and that we haven't covered that they should know, that you would like them to know?
About storyboarding?
Yeah. Storyboarding, yeah.
Oh, God. You know, honestly, it's just watch as many movies as you can and study the supplementals, all the making ofs, all the documentaries, all the commentaries, because that's free film school. I know Paul Thomas Anderson said that once, the good one. And he emphasized to the nth degree, this is stuff that you can't buy or pay for. Because no matter what film school you go to, you know, Pressburger's not going to go there and speak. Scorsese's not going to go there and speak. Well, he might. But the point, Pressburger won't, though, because he's dead.
He's dead.
Right. That'd be a tough speech.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, awesome. Well, thanks, Ryan, for being on our show.
Oh, thank you. It was a blast.
We hope you come back maybe when Spider-Man 3 comes out.
It's untitled. Spider-Man. Something tells me a little bird.
It'll be like the Broadway show.
I bet you it'll be called. Oh, I wonder about that, actually.
And it'll be called What a Tangled Web We Weave.
This is not an insider thing. I'm just assuming they'll say something like The Amazing Spider-Man. But you know what? Don't quote me on that. I could be totally wrong, and I could be...
And so who is Reese Ifans playing?
Reese Ifans plays... You know what? I think it broke in Ain't It Cool News. Go to Ain't It Cool News, check the negative reaction to something, because I think it's the best thing ever, because those meatheads have no idea what they're talking about.
No one listens to our show. Anyway. You don't have to worry.
But Reese Ifans plays a very compelling villain, brought to you by the Sony Vio. Did you see Social Network? It was nothing but Vios left and right. So any Columbia film, it's lovely.
Okay, awesome. Cool. Well, thanks again, and we'll see you when's that supposed to come out even? I don't know.
It'll come out 2012.
Well, then
this show is not brought to you by Sony Vio. This show is brought to you by the miracle of the Chill Pack.
It's under there.
You know, this by the way, this laptop, you should have heard it before you came in. It was whipping up sound like the hurricane outside.
I was wondering what that noise was when I was walking up.
But now he's got a Chill Pack underneath the laptop. It's running silent, running deep. And
I'll take five.
And running fast. It's the Gel Pack cooling device that takes your laptop computer and keeps it running fast by keeping it cool. It makes an excellent gift. It's environmentally friendly. It's easy to use. Check it out at chillpack.com. CHILLPAK.com. Till next week, I'm Phil Aaron.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then. Thanks, Charlie. Woohoo!